Good morning. This is Thomas Golden. I'm the Associate Director here at the Employment and Disability Institute in the ILR School at Cornell University, and we want to welcome you to our webinar today on the New York State Disability and Employment Status Report. This is a rollout webinar of our annual production of the status report that is done, and joining me today from our web and media studios here at Cornell University is Bill Erickson, who is a research specialist with the Institute and has worked diligently for the past 3 years with an array of different research initiatives that have been sponsored by the Medicaid Infrastructure Grant that has been funded by the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. Also joining me today is Sarah von Schrader, another co-author of the Status Report. Sarah is the Assistant Director of Research here at the Employment and Disability Institute, and joining us as well is Zafar Nazarov, who is a research associate with us, who also has worked extensively on several research publications that we have produced as a result of the New York Makes Work Pay initiative. I'm your moderator for today, Thomas Golden. During today's broadcast, at any time, if you have questions pertaining to the information that's going to be presented, we encourage you to submit your questions via chat. As a participant, you are muted throughout the presentation, and then at the end of the presentation, we will have a period for questions and answers. I will take those questions in the order that they're received, and we will try to answer as many as we can during our allotted time today. The New York Makes Work Pay initiative is a comprehensive employment system Medicaid infrastructure grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, to the Office of Mental Health on behalf of New York State. It's a joint effort of the Burton Blatt Institute at Syracuse University and the Employment and Disability Institute here at Cornell University, with the collaborative support of the Employment Committee of the New York State Most Integrated Settings Coordinating Council, focused to remove barriers to employment and develop pathways to work for New Yorkers with disabilities. So thank you for joining us today. In our presentation, we're going to be providing you a picture today of disability and employment among New York State's working age population, with a focus specifically today on disability prevalence, disparities between people with and without disabilities in employment, educational attainment, and financial security, people who are working and potential barriers to work that they're experiencing, and finally, program participation and outcomes of programs designed to serve individuals with disabilities. So, without further ado, we're going to get started. And again, welcome.
All right. Thank you, Thomas. This is Bill Erickson. First, what I'd like to talk about briefly is just to give you a little background on a lot of on the information we'll be presenting here today. Much of it is based on numbers. The numbers in this report are based on the U.S. Census Bureau's American Community Survey, abbreviated as the ACS, the 2010 data. And note that that the ACS only includes six basic disability questions, and it isn't. Those six questions don't include all people with disabilities, but it's the most current population-based disability information available at the state level. Again, it's based on the 2010 data, and most of the data that we present here is we're looking at only look at the working age population, primarily the ages 21 to 64. So, and in New York State, the overall disability prevalence rate for the working age civilian population is about 11.5 million people. And of this group, about nearly 100,000 people, 969,900 people, or about 8.5%, report having one or more disabilities. This is lower than the overall national average of 10.3% across the nation. So 8.5 versus 10.3, so somewhat lower. Next slide, please. Now, disability rates increase with age, as this table shows. Persons aged 16 to 44 average around 5 to 6% disability prevalence rate. The prevalence rate rises to about 10% for persons ages 45 to 54, and it goes up to 16% for persons aged 55 to 64 in New York State. This obviously has major implications as the baby boomers age and a larger proportion of workers fall into these older age groups. Next slide, please. Okay, as I mentioned earlier, the American Communities Survey asks six different questions regarding disability. And this chart shows the disability prevalence rate for the working age population by the different types of disability. Now, the most common disability type is ambulatory disability, which refers to difficulty walking or climbing stairs, and that's 4.5% again for the working age population. 3.3% had a cognitive disability, and those are people with serious difficulty concentrating, remembering, or making decisions. 3.1% had an independent living disabilities, which refers to people with difficulty doing errands alone, such as visiting a doctor's office or shopping. And 1.6% have a self-care disability, which refers to people with difficulty dressing or bathing. 1.5% report having a hearing disability, and visual disabilities were the least common at 1.2%. Of people who reported a disability, nearly half, 43.3%, reported more than one disability type. So these disabilities were determined through a survey. These are all self-reported disabilities. And of those, nearly half reported, of people who reported any one of them, nearly half reported one or more than one disability type. Next slide, please. Okay, in this next section, we'll present some comparisons and discrepancies between the population with and without disabilities living in New York State. Of course, employment is one of the major issues of interest. This bar chart compares the employment status of New Yorkers with and without disabilities, ages 21 to 64. The top bar is the individuals with disability, and the bottom bar is those without disability. Only about a third, or 31.3%, of persons with disabilities are employed, compared to about nearly three quarters of persons without disabilities, and that's the blue portion of these charts. This is an employment gap in the black bar of 43.4%, so it's a huge employment gap between people with and without disabilities. Note that although the proportion of those who are not working but actively looking for work, which is virtually identical, this is the green bar labeled unemployed, about 7% of each of the groups are not working but are actively looking for work. Nearly three times as many people with disabilities are out of labor force, which is the red bar, not working or looking for work, as compared to those without disabilities. So about 60% of people with disabilities are neither working nor looking for work, as compared to only 18.2% of people without disabilities are not working or looking for work. Okay, now we commissioned some questions in a Cornell University Empire poll using the ACS disability questions to identify people with disabilities, along with additional items that we thought would be useful to gather further information regarding people with disabilities in New York State. One of the things that we found was that people with disabilities are more likely than those without to be discouraged about job prospects. People with disabilities are more likely to be dissatisfied with the quality and availability of jobs in their community, nearly three quarters of them, than people without disabilities, according to a 2011 Empire poll. So other possible reasons for discouraged workers, people not working looking for work, could include such things as disincentives due to programs such as SSI or SSDI, where people might feel they're better off staying with those programs, difficulty of getting back on the rolls if they needed to after starting to work, and also could be related to negative experiences on the job market. So how is New York doing in terms of employment relative to other states? This slide shows a map of the U.S. Displaying the employment gaps by state, so the gaps between people with and without disabilities with regards to employment. The darker states are those with the greatest employment gaps. New York is among those with the largest gaps. New York has the 14th highest gap between people with employment gap between people with and without disabilities out of the 50 states. So they're not among the states with the worst gaps, which are the darkest blue, which include Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and as the other darker area states. We're on in the sort of range where those were Illinois, Michigan, Connecticut, and those states were sort of in that same sort of range there with those states. Next slide, please. Okay, of course, now, as you probably would expect, employment rates vary by disability type. And this table shows the employment rates by the six different disability types. The employment rate is highest for people with a hearing disability. Nearly half people with hearing disabilities are employed, 50.4%. About a third of people with visual impairments are employed. Slightly less than a quarter of those with ambulatory or cognitive disabilities are employed. And only about one in six persons with a self-care, independent living, independent living disability are employed. And the same is the situation for people who are reporting more than one disability type. Again, only about a third are actually employed. Now, this slide shows two other special populations of interest. The first is shows the proportion of transition-age youth, which are we define as youth that are ages 16 to 24 with disabilities, are far less likely to be in either school or working than those without disabilities. Youth without disabilities, 85.9% are either in school or employed or both, as compared to only 65.1% of youth with disabilities being employed or in school. The chart on the right shows the employment status of civilian veterans with service-connected disabilities. So those are disabilities that are determined by the Veterans Administration. In New York State, there are nearly 500,000 civilian working-age veterans, of whom nearly 70,000, or 14.6%, have a service-connected disability. Only about half of vets with service-connected disabilities are employed, compared to about two-thirds of veterans without service-connected disabilities. So there's a fairly sizable gap between those with a veterans with a service-connected disability and those without, with regards to employment. So what might be part of the explanation of these low employment rates overall? As you know, that employment and earnings are both related to education. Persons with higher education are more likely to be employed and earn more. This chart shows the educational discrepancies between persons with and without disabilities. The bar, or the vertical bar on the left are individuals with disabilities. The bar on the right are those without disabilities. Nearly a quarter of persons with disabilities have less than a high school education, as compared to only 1 in 10 of those without a disability. So they're clearly, you know, group without with less than a high school education are far less. Have far fewer skills to bring in and education to bring into the employment market. In addition, the other large discrepancy here shown in purple is that persons without disabilities are more than twice as likely to have a bachelor's degree or higher than persons without disabilities. Only about 16% of persons with disabilities have a bachelor's degree or higher as compared to 36% of people without disabilities. So this lopsidedness in terms of the educational attainment could have serious implications regarding employment. So what does employment look like by educational attainment? If you're sort of controlling for that in this chart, where we're displaying the employment rates for people with and without disabilities by different educational attainment levels. As education attainment increases, as I mentioned before, the employment rate also increases. There's a relative leap in the employment rate from 18% to 31% between the people with disability, between those with or without disability, sorry, with, for people looking at people with disabilities, between those with and without a high school diploma in the first two sets of bars. They go from 18.4% of people with disabilities but with less than a high school education are employed, up and that nearly doubles when people with disabilities have a high school diploma or equivalent. So that's a pretty significant leap right there, just at the level of being able of having a high school degree. While the disparity between people with and without disabilities narrows as education increases, it still persists. For those with less than high school education, as I mentioned, they're going from about a third the rate of those without disabilities, going from 18% education rate for those people with less than a high school education and with a disability to 60% of those people without a disability in education level and less than a high school education level. And things improve slightly and to result with about half of people with a BA or higher with a disability are employed, 47% versus 82% of people without a disability are employed and have a bachelor's degree or higher. So the employment ratio increases substantially at that level, but still, as you can see, it's still quite a bit lower than people without disabilities with that same education level. Now I'll hand this over to Sarah von Schroeder to talk about poverty.
Great. Thank you, Bill. So Bill has been talking about disparities in employment and educational attainment between people with and without disabilities. And closely related to employment and educational attainment is financial security. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about poverty rates, which is one indicator of financial security. As we look at this graph right here, you can see the poverty rates for people with a disability in blue and those without a disability. So the poverty rate among people with a disability in New York State is 28.3% compared to 11.7% for people with no disability. So we've sort of talked about gaps before, the difference between those two rates. And in black, you can see that the poverty gap is 16.6 percentage points. So really, despite existence of public support such as SSI and SSDI, working people with disabilities are 2.4 times more likely to be living in poverty than their non-disabled peers. Bill talked a little bit about some data from the 2011 Empire poll earlier, and another question that we had on there, we asked about sort of how people felt if they were worse off financially now as compared to a year ago. And this was fielded in 2011. And nearly half of New Yorkers with disabilities polled felt that they were worse off financially now compared to a year ago. And that's compared to only about 27% of people without disabilities. All of this information that we're presenting today, of course, is available on our New York State Employment and Disability Status Report. It's available online. And within that report, we talk a little bit more about the economic climate in New York State over the last few years. Obviously, there's been a pretty major recession, and that's taken a toll. And so we delve into that in a little more deeply than we're going to do in this presentation. So I recommend looking at that because I think it's sort of an interesting write-up. In terms of poverty rate by disability type, Bill talked a little bit about the different disability types in some of his earlier slides. The poverty rate is highest among people with a cognitive disability at about 35% and lowest among people with a hearing disability at just under 20%. And this sort of matches up with what Bill showed earlier, that people with hearing disabilities have higher employment rates. Poverty rates for other disability types range from about 30% to 33% for the other groups, which were ambulatory disability, self-care disability, visual disability, and independent living disability. In our report, we also talk about a couple of other indicators of financial security, including assets and specifically savings, as well as looking at a couple indicators of financial security related to housing. We know that asset accumulation can be a challenge for people with disabilities. For example, SSI recipients are required to limit their assets. And in general, the under and unemployment of many people with disabilities makes savings really difficult. From our Empire poll, we found that less than half of people with disabilities had adequate financial assets to get by if they had to support themselves for 3 months with no earned income or gifts from others. And this compares to two-thirds of persons without disabilities. So that's a pretty big difference in sort of the feeling of financial security among the two groups. Looking at housing, we see that the homeownership levels among households that contain a working age person with a disability are much lower, much less likely to own a home or have a mortgage, and much more likely to rent than households that do not include a working age person with a disability. We also see that the percent of income spent on housing is significantly higher for those households with a working age person with a disability. I'm going to shift quickly. We talk a little bit in the report about access to healthcare, and I think this is another really important area where we see some disparities and some differences, still related to financial security, though. So I want to present a little bit of information about health insurance and access to healthcare. We know that lack of access to healthcare services can make life a lot more difficult for people with disabilities. And we know that health insurance coverage is linked to the quality of care that individuals receive. We know from the American Community Survey that about 90% of working age New Yorkers with disabilities have health insurance coverage. And this is actually higher than the percent of people without disabilities, where it's about 82.7%. So people with disabilities are more likely to be insured. We also know that people with disabilities are more likely to have public health coverage, for instance, Medicare or Medicaid, with about 60% of people with disabilities having public health insurance, compared to about 14% of their non-disabled peers. And I think it's interesting that even though people with disabilities are more likely to be insured, our Empire poll showed that people with disabilities still have difficulty accessing healthcare because of cost. We see that nearly a third of people with disabilities did not get needed medical care because they couldn't afford it. And this is compared to 1 in 10 people without disabilities. Even with health insurance, healthcare is expensive. There are copay, deductibles, copays, and coinsurance. And those who have a limited income often have difficulty paying costs, especially if they're being utilized frequently. So far, we've been talking about sort of the overall population and looking at disparities between people with and without disabilities in the overall population. So now we're going to move from focusing on this overall population and narrow just to look at people who are working. And in this section, we're going to examine sort of industries and occupations of people with disabilities and also talk a little bit about barriers to work, including transportation and a little bit about employment discrimination. So at the beginning, Bill talked about the employment rates of people with and without disabilities, and he noted that about 30% of people with disabilities are employed compared to about 75% of people without disabilities, more or less. And he noted that this is a really large employment gap. So if we're just talking about that, approximately 30% of people with disabilities are working, those folks are much more likely to be working part-time or not consistently employed throughout the year than those who are than people without disabilities. So just looking at workers, only about 60% of workers with disabilities work full-time full year, compared to 74% of workers without disabilities. So just to define what I mean when we're talking about full-time full year, it would be 35 hours a week and at least 50 weeks in the last 12 months is considered full-time, full year. So if we just think about the New York State workforce, so our workforce 16 and older, about 4% of the New York State workforce has a disability. We see that there are some industries that have a higher proportion of people with disabilities. For example, agriculture, forestry, fishing, and hunting, and mining have about 6.2% of their workforce is composed of people with disabilities. As transportation, warehousing, and utilities, there are about 4.9% of the workforce is composed of people with disabilities. Manufacturing, again, it's higher than 4.1% at 4.6%. And educational services, healthcare, and social assistance is about 4.6% of the workforce is people with disabilities. And it should be noted that that it's not necessarily clear that these industries are more disability friendly, or if the jobs within these industries are more likely to lead to individuals becoming disabled. And then finally, people with disabilities are less highly represented in the areas of finance, insurance, real estate, rental, and leasing, and information, where less than 3% of the New York State workforce is composed of people with disabilities. So we talked a little bit about industry, and now we're going to talk a little bit about the occupations of working people age 16 and over by disability status. So when comparing the occupations of employed people with and without disabilities, people with disabilities are less likely to be employed in management, business, science, and arts occupations. So this is the first set of bars here. So about 28.6% of people with disabilities are employed in these occupations, compared to about 38.9% of people without disabilities are employed in these occupations. So more people without a disability are employed in these occupations. We see sort of the opposite within service occupations, as well as production, transportation, and moving occupations, which are sort of at the end of this figure here. So within service occupations, about 24.9% of people with disabilities work in service occupations, compared to 19.7% of people with no disabilities. Again, people with a disability are more likely to be employed in production, transportation, material moving occupations at about 14.4% of people with a disability are employed in these occupations, compared to 9.5% of people with no disability. It's very, very similar between people with and without disability in sales and office occupations. About 24.4% of each of these groups with and without disability are in sales and office occupations, and they're fairly similar numbers for natural resources, construction, and maintenance occupations, with about 7.8% of people with a disability in these occupations and about 7.5% of people with no disability in these occupations. Although it's not presented here, the rate of self-employment among employing people with disabilities is about 11%, and it's really similar to the rate of people without disabilities in self-employment, which is about 10%. And now I'm going to briefly talk about a couple of potential barriers to employment for people with disabilities, in particular transportation and discrimination. And in our 2011 Empire poll, we learned that about a third of people with disabilities said that inadequate transportation was a problem for them. And that compares to only about 1 in 10 people without disabilities. We know that access to public transportation and other options may reduce that barrier. And in the figure that you see now, we present how workers with disabilities in New York State commute to work. This actually, I think up till now, we've really sort of presented people with disabilities and without disabilities and made that comparison. If you create this same pie chart for people with disabilities, or without disabilities, it looks very, very similar. So we're just going to present how workers with disabilities in New York State commute to work. You can see that about 50% drive alone, about 9% carpool, about 25% take public transportation, 6% walked, about 6% worked at home, and about 3% used other means like taxi cab, motorcycle, bicycle. I think it's just sort of interesting to look at this. I think that one thing that we should think about, of course, is that if we're looking at New York City versus the rest of the state, public transportation is much more highly utilized in New York City than it is in the rest of the state. And we could break this down further, and it might be a little bit more interesting because there is such a higher use of public transportation within New York City, and that really bumps up what we see here with 25% using public transportation. This is another area where we have a bit more within the report, and I'm not going to spend too much time today because we probably don't have enough time to get into a lot of detail. But one other key factor that may keep people with disabilities from really fully engaging in employment is workplace discrimination. At the Employment and Disability Institute, we have access to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's Integrated Mission System data. And this is a database that the EEOC uses to track charges of employment discrimination that are filed under the Americans with Disabilities Act, as well as other statutes that employment discrimination related statutes. But we're particularly interested in the Americans with Disabilities Act here. And these data can be really useful. It can be really useful information about where in the employment process people with disabilities are perceiving discrimination. Here I'm presenting the most commonly cited issues and impairments on New York State employment discrimination charges. And we've grouped charges from 2005 to 2010. By far the most common issue that's cited on employment discrimination charges is discharge. And around 60% of charges cite discharge as the issue in question. It is possible to cite more than one issue, and some of the other issues that come up frequently in order are terms and conditions. Number three is reasonable accommodation, harassment, discipline, hiring, and wages. And I would say, essentially, once we get down to hiring, not that many people are citing hiring, probably because it's sort of hard to determine if you've been discriminated against during the hiring process. So I believe we don't have the number here. It is within the report. But it's around 6% of charges cite hiring as an issue, compared to about 60% citing discharge. There are other issues related to termination, for instance, involuntary retirement and layoff. And when we combine all of those different categories, most charges are related to a termination-related issue. Reasonable accommodation, we see on about between 25 and 30% of charges. And then if we look over at the second column here, we have a list of the most common impairments. There are a lot of different, these are called sort of the basis of the charge. And there are a lot of sort of non-specific bases, like other disability, or there are bases like retaliation. What we've done is just pulled out the most common impairments that you see on employment discrimination charges in New York State in order, and they are orthopedic structural back is the most common, followed by other psychiatric disorder, heart cardiovascular, non-paralytic orthopedic, diabetes, missing digits and limbs, and cancer. So those were the most common impairments. So within the report, and there's quite a bit of data in there. We present sort of the percent of charges that cite each of these issues and impairments. It should be noted with impairments, you can also cite more than one impairment on a charge. And then it also compares New York State, the rate of people citing that issue or impairment, and compare that to charges nationally. So there's quite a bit more detail within the report, and if you're interested in learning a little bit more there. So now we're going to move into another section. As you can know from the title, our report focuses on employment. And so in this section, we're presenting some data that's related to SSI, SSDI, and work incentive program participation. When people with disabilities are receiving Social Security disability income or supplemental security income, making the decision to return to work can be difficult. It may mean the loss of not only cash benefits, but also of Medicaid or Medicare-provided health insurance. And one of the goals of the New York Makes Work Pay project is to increase access to work incentive planning and health care for people with disabilities who would like to work. So in this section, we present some information about recipients of SSI and SSDI and focus on return to work rates and the use of work incentives. Most of this information is from the statistical reports produced by the Social Security Administration, and they're really some basic numbers. And as I said, as with everything else, you can find this in the within our report. So I'm just going to talk really briefly through some of these numbers. We know that SSI is an important source of income for many working age New Yorkers with disabilities. And according to the ACS, nearly 1 in 4 receive SSI, working age New Yorkers with disabilities. There are about 560,000 SSI recipients with disabilities in New York State in 2010, not limited to working age. And of these, about 28,000, or about 4.9%, worked. You can see from the second bullet here that the percent working has decreased each year since 2006. So in 2006, about 6.2% of SSI recipients worked. It was 6% in 2007, 5.9% in 2008, 5.6% in 2009, and down to what I mentioned before, which is 4.9% in 2010. The economy has not been great, and I'm sure that that plays a role in what we're seeing there. So this figure shows the number of SSI recipients using various work incentives. We just noted that there's been a decrease in the percent of SSI recipients who are working. And there's also been some shifts in the utilization of work incentives. From 2006 to 2010, there was a decrease in utilization of the impairment-related work expense. That's the green line that you see. This incentive encourages SSI recipients to work by allowing specific expenses to be deducted from the earnings that they use to calculate the SSI benefit. So that's decreased from under, around 475 recipients utilizing that in 2006 down to about 325 in 2010. The blind work expense, which is the blue bar that you see, utilization decreased somewhat from 2006 to 2009, and then we saw a little uptick in 2010, which is good. And then plan to achieve self-support, or PASS, which is the red bar at the bottom, is an SSI work incentive that allows one to use income or assets to reach work goals, and had a modest increase in utilization from 2007 to 2010. And so in 2010, there were close to 100 participants in PASS. Very quickly, I'm going to go through Social Security disability insurance. In 2010, approximately 4.4% of the working age population received SSDI. The majority of SSDI recipients are workers, as opposed to family members, and there were about 491,000 New York State workers of any age receiving SSDI in 2010. The working age population receiving SSDI, the second bullet, has been increasing over the last 5 years. So in 2006, 3.8% of the working age population received SSDI, increasing to 3.9% in 2007, 4% in 2008, 4.2% in 2009, and up to 4.4% in 2010, which I mentioned at the beginning. Let's see, we have more details within our report on two groups of SSDI workers, those who had benefits withheld because of substantial work, and those who successfully returned to work. From 2006 to 2009, the percent of SSDI workers who had benefits withheld because of substantial work remained fairly stable at 0.7%. But in 2010, this percent decreased slightly to 0.5%. The percent of SSDI workers who successfully returned to work decreased somewhat from 2006 to 2009. It decreased from 0.7% to 0.4%. But then we saw actually an increase again in 2010 to 0.6%, which is, I believe, a good sign. As noted earlier, the fear of losing health insurance when returning to work can be a major barrier to returning to the workforce. To address that, the concern that those who receive Medicaid or Medicare will lose their health insurance when they return to work, the Medicaid buy-in program for working people with disabilities allows a working person with a disability to obtain health care coverage under Medicaid. In this figure, we present the Medicaid buy-in for working people with disabilities enrollment from 2006 to 2010. And the utilization of this program has been increasing over the last 5 years. In 2010, by the end of 2010, as of December 31st of that year, there were over 9,000 participants in the Medicaid buy-in program. This is not quite twice as many as there were in 2006. So there's been really a great increase in this work incentive program. So I'm going to let Zafar Nazaroff take over at this point.
So in our report, you can find information about key performance indicators for four state agencies and some information about utilization, a number of individuals participating in support employment services, and wages and average working hours, weekly working hours of individuals participating in support employment services in New York State for the last 5 years. We used different data sources to compute the statistics. In particular, we used Chapter 515. We used also RSA 911 and NISER data system. So in our report, we included statistics mainly for, as I said, for four state agencies that provided a variety of employment services to individuals with disabilities. And these agencies are Adult Career and Continuing Education Services, known as AccessVR, Commission for the Blind and Visually Handicapped, CBVH, Office for People with Developmental Disabilities, OPWDD, and Office of Mental Health, OMH. We have some information about limited information about the number of participants of Office of Alcohol and Substance Abuse, OASIS. So in state fiscal year 2010, AccessVR provided a variety of services to over 103,000 individuals. And at the end of 2010, of these cases, slightly over 27,000 cases were successfully or unsuccessfully closed with codes 26, 28, 30, and 42,862 cases had signed individual plans for employment were still current, and about slightly less than 34,000 cases were pending the either eligibility decision or they were determined eligible but were pending the development of individual plan for employment. In 2010, CBVH provided employment services to 3,875 individuals. As of November 2010, OPWDD was serving slightly less than 22,000 people with developmental disabilities in a variety of work programs. Mainly, to our knowledge, those individuals were spread across two programs, such as support employment and sheltered workshops programs. So in state fiscal year 2010, OMH surveyed 3,861 individuals with mental disorders in ongoing integrated support employment program, and 6,250 individuals in personalized recovery-oriented services known as PROS. Finally, as to our knowledge, about 13,000 people received some type of work-related activity through OASIS, and this could include the services provided by OASIS could include vocational evaluation, training, job preparation, or education services for individuals with alcoholism and substance abuse disorders. So approximately 8,000 OASIS clients were employed for the first time in state fiscal year 2009-2010. Next slide, please. So this slide demonstrated the key performance indicators for two agencies in New York State, such as XSVR and CBVH. We computed these indicators using RC 911 data. Then we compared them with the similar indicators computed for the whole population of the VR consumers in the US. Again, we used RSA 911 for this purpose. So it should be noted that in calculation of these indicators, we restricted our sample to consumers with developed and signed IPE, individual plans for employment, who received any services according to this plans, and whose cases were closed in a particular year. So the first figure depicts the percentage of VR consumers with significant disabilities who achieved an employment outcome with earnings. In New York State, the percentage of individuals with significant disabilities participating in these programs who achieved an employment outcome with earnings has decreased from 58.5% in 2006 to 47.4% in 2010. So, and the second figure depicts the percentage of VR consumers with significant disabilities receiving public support at application, which is SSI-SSDI benefits, who achieved an employment outcome with earnings. Again, the percentage of individuals with significant disabilities receiving public support in the form of SSI-SSDI at application and who achieve an employment outcome with earnings has decreased substantially from 51.5% to 41.8% over the same period. Next slide, please. We also computed a key performance indicator for transition-aged youths. So the next slide demonstrates the percentage of transition-aged youths who achieved an employment outcome with earnings. And we define the transition-aged youths, those whose age on the day of signing individual plan of employment was above 16 years old, but below 25 years. So the percentage of transition age youths who achieved an employment outcome with earnings has dropped from 57% to 44.2% in New York in the period between 2006 and 2010. One thing is certain that, as it would be expected, the recession have led to decreasing performance as measured by these indicators, not only in New York State, but also in the United States. And you can see this in the given in the last three figures. Next slide, please. So we also utilize New York Integrated Support Employment data system to compute some statistics related to participation in support employment programs. Many consumers of AccessVR, CBVH, OPWDD, and OMH actually participate in support employment programs. And as you know, probably the main goal of support employment program is to improve employment outcomes of individuals with significant or severe disabilities. So it should be noted that the services and employment outcomes of these consumers had been tracked using a cross-agency database called the New York State Interagency Support Employment Reporting System. No, it's New York State Integrated Support Employment Reporting System, sorry. Before introduction of New York Employment Service System, NIAS, the new service system started functioning from beginning from January 1st. So this slide demonstrates the number of individuals participating in support employment programs by state agency for the period between January to March 2005 and November 2010. I have to warn that we excluded all cases, all consumers who were in the system but who didn't receive any services in a given quarter. So the numbers, the actual numbers of in this figure could be slightly lower from the number of individuals in the system, because some individuals might not be receiving any services but still be in the system. So in the first quarter of 2010, a total of 17,578 individuals in New York with significant disabilities participated in support employment programs. And of this, 7,791 were consumers were AccessVR or CBVH consumers, 6,991 were OPWDD consumers, and 2,616 were OMH consumers. So it should be worthwhile to know that the total number of individuals participating in support employment programs in New York State declined by nearly 3,000 consumers during 2010, with 14,662 individuals participating during the last quarter of 2010. It should be noted that according to RSA 9/11, about slightly more than 24% of consumers who are participating in vocational rehabilitation programs in New York State receive support employment services, which is twice more than the number for United States. In the United States, overall in the United States, only 11% of individuals participating in vocational rehabilitation programs actually receive support employment services. So next slide. The good thing about the NISER data system was, and NISE as well, is that they track wages and working hours of consumers participating in support employment programs. So you can see the variation across time, across agencies, and this figure actually depicts these variations for you. So this particular slide demonstrates average hourly wages. For the comparability purpose across years, the wages normalized to December 2010 dollars. So in 2010, the average hourly wages of AccessVR, CBVH, and OMH consumers were in the range of $8.72 per hour. OPWD consumers earned slightly lower hourly wages, about $8 per hour. And it's worthwhile to mention that the hourly wages of AccessVR, CBVH, and OMH consumers were fairly steady over the last 5 years, while the hourly wages of OPWD consumers have increased by about 50 cents per hour. Next slide, please. So this slide demonstrates the average weekly working hours of individuals participating in support employment programs by state agency in New York State. So again, in 2010, AccessVR CBVH support employment consumers on average worked about 25 hours per week. If you compare this number with OMH consumers, the OMH consumers worked slightly more than 22 hours per week, which is 3 hours per week differential between between average consumers of AccessVR and average consumers of OMH. And OPWDD consumers worked even less, 20 hours per week. One of the interesting facts of support employment program in New York State for the last 5 years is that weekly working hours of support employment consumers have decreased by slightly more than 1 hour for all agencies for a given period. Thank you. So, if you have questions, we'll be glad to answer your questions.
Thank you, Zafar and Sarah and Bill. And I've just been kind of monitoring questions as they've been coming in. Again, I want to remind our listeners today that if you do have any questions as a result of the report that's been presented, to simply type those into the chat box. And we'll be taking those in the order that they come. And so the first, in Zafar, Bill, and Sarah, I'm not for sure who wants to field this, but we did have a question coming in asking why we did not use any New York State Division of Human Rights data in the report. Who'd like to address that?
I can address that. This is Sarah. That's a great question, and I didn't go into a lot of detail about what was in the EEOC's integrated mission system. But both Fair Employment Practice Agencies and EEOC offices input into the integrated mission system. So we have data from the New York State Division of Human Rights as well as the EEOC offices of the New York State. So we have both Fair Employment Practice Agencies and New York State. And we don't differentiate usually when we're making presentations and presenting data on perceived discrimination. We're just putting those all together. So I think that's described a little bit better within the report and the source notes within the report. But that is a great question because I don't think I was at all clear about what exactly goes into the data that we summarized there.
Thank you, Sarah. Zafar, I have one for you that perhaps you could address. And the question comes in, and it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, I think, but it says, how accurate is the NICER data really?
Yeah, it's a really great question about the accurateness of the completeness and accurateness of any administrative data set. And it's hard to check the accurateness. I would just say that the completeness of the NICER data for the wage variables and the working hours variables is very good. I mean, about 98% of the consumers of observations have information about wage and working hours. How they're accurate, it's hard to check because there's no other source to cross-reference those numbers. And we're looking forward to do this evaluation of the NICER system in the future. Then we will compare what the average wages was in NICER compared with the new numbers generated, which will be generated using the new system. But my understanding is that at least the wage and working hours data should be inputted accurately. Inputted accurately because we even compared them with the numbers using the RSA 9/11 data, which we didn't include this comparison in our report. But if someone interested, I can provide these numbers, and you will see that actually NICER average wages computed using NIDER data match well with the average wages computed RSA 9 level 11 data. Similar was for working hours, weekly working hours.
Thank you, Zafar, very much. Nicole, I'm going to ask you to retype your question. It did not come through to us. But in the meantime, we did have another question come in that I will field. The question was asking what a good source of comprehensive information regarding employer incentives to hire people with disabilities. What would be a good resource for that? And I'm going to suggest that you consider going to askearn.org. It's an exceptional resource that is available online. That's askearn, askearn.org. And AskEarn is an information-based resource for employers, provides a reference desk, lots of information about the different types of incentives, as well as the business case for hiring individuals with disabilities. That is sponsored by the U.S. Department of Education through Cornell University's National Employer Technical Assistance Center. So once again, that resource is askearn.org. Another question came in, and again, Sarah, Bill, and Zafar, I'm not for sure who would field this, but it comes in and it asks, on slide 33, transition-aged youth, what are the numbers behind the percentages? New York compared to the United States, can you comment or explain further? And so I don't know, Sarah, if perhaps you want to go back to slide 33 so that individuals can actually see that. And then if one of you could perhaps explain that again. What are the numbers behind the percentages? Is that New York compared to the U.S.? Can you comment or explain further?
It's actually Zafar. It's my numbers, which I computed using the RSA 9-11 data. So this is the percent of transition age youth achieve an employment outcome with earning. So we know that individuals who actually enter the vocational rehabilitation program, because they can the access VR deviation determine whether those individuals eligible for the receipt of services, then after determining eligibility, if individual found eligible for services, then the individual plan of employment developed, and if individuals agreed with this IP, with the suggested IP, then he signs this IP and he starts receiving the services. So at when we compute these numbers, we use only those individuals or those transition age youth who actually signed their individual plans of employment and received services. And then after receiving services, some youths, the case is closed either successfully or unsuccessfully. So the successful case is if individual achieved employment with their earnings. So we computed the percent of transition age youths who achieve employment outcome with earnings among those who received services. So it shows that in New York State, the percentage of transition age youth who achieved an employment outcome for earnings has just was 57% in 2006, and this number went down to 44% in New York in the period between 2010. We did a similar calculation using RSA 9-11 for the whole population of youth, transition age youth in the United States, and we actually see the similar decline in the percentage of transition age youth who achieved an employment outcome with earnings. I hope I answered this question. If you please email me if you have further question.
Thank you, Zafar, very much. Another question for the team is, in addition to the recession, do you believe that program funding cuts and hiring freezes contributed to declining employment outcomes for individuals with disabilities? And I know our data didn't look specifically at that, but I wondered if maybe either of the three of you maybe have comment about that. Now, don't all jump at once. I know it's kind of a difficult question to answer, right, because we don't have hard data that we looked at to answer that. But do either of you maybe have your own impression?
Yeah, I mean, we believe that currently we're working on the cost effectiveness of the different vocational rehabilitation services in the state of New York. In New York State, we're trying to understand whether the during the current fiscal austerity due to, we're trying to understand whether the if we decline the cost, how that would affect if we decline the average cost, how that would affect the effectiveness of the vocational rehabilitation services. So far, we don't have it, the certain numbers which say that yes, the decline is mostly due to the decline in effectiveness. But actually, we believe that this could be the case, that the cut in the funding may contribute to a decline in employment outcomes for individuals with disabilities in New York State.
Thank you, Zafar. We had another question that I'm going to field, if you don't mind. The question came in, with the increased participation in the Medicaid buy-in for Working People with Disabilities program in New York State, which has been considerable over the last 3 years, why isn't there a bigger impact on employment outcomes in the state? And it's actually a really good question. The thing you need to understand about the Medicaid buy-in program is the Medicaid buy-in program doesn't actually translate to potentially all new individuals entering the workforce. Keep in mind, the Medicaid buy-in program, as it was originally conceptualized and conceived and designed, was really intended to provide an important health care safety net for individuals who were potentially already working and may have lost their Medicaid and or Medicare as a result of their earnings and needed to buy into the healthcare program. And so I would never expect, in light of the nature of the Medicaid buy-in program, that the increase in numbers would translate exactly to an increase in employment outcomes within any state where we've seen the program implemented, for the primary reason that these are individuals who, for the most part, probably were already working. There will be some subsequent research that I know Arun Kapoor and Zafar Nazaroff and myself are doing here in New York State through the Department of Health Administrative Data to understand a little bit more of the working behaviors and characteristics as well as costs of the Medicaid buy-in program. And so, but it's a great question. What I would tell you to do is to stay tuned, that eventually somewhere here in the next few months, we will be engaging in an additional webinar where we actually share some of the results of that research. And that might actually begin to answer this question as well as to others in regard to what impact actually has the Medicaid buy-in for working with people with disabilities had in New York State. Another question is coming in is whether or not, Bill, Zafar, and Sarah, you have all looked at the interaction of disability with race, gender, and ethnicity issues related to employment. So for our listening audience, as you see this pause, I'm looking through my door into the studio where they all are, and I see them engaged in discussion as to who's going to take this one and discussion about how they're going to answer it. So please, we're not having technical difficulties. We're having researcher difficulties deciding who's going to actually field it. So we appreciate your patience.
All right, this is Bill Erickson. That's certainly something we could look into. We haven't at this point. We could look at that in terms of the American Community Survey data that much of the first portion of the presentation, the numbers that I presented, we could examine that. We haven't looked at that specifically for New York State. It gets pretty complex when you're looking across gender, if you try to include all of those different variables, it can be pretty complex. I think Zafar here has some suggestions, but he's actually looked at some of these issues as well.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. Yeah, we had the study here at EDI where we're looking at the factors associated with the wage disparities between Caucasian and African American consumers participating in vocational rehabilitation services. I don't remember exactly the difference in the wages between two groups on average is $1.62, but we're trying to understand what factors are actually associated with this difference, with the wage disparity. Is it because differences in observed characteristics, or the services received, or the phase difference environmental, environmental factors? So this is ongoing research, but we're looking, but we didn't include this in the state report.
Thank you, Zafar, very much. We have we've had a couple questions come in, that I think are somewhat subjective, and so I'm going to reference them. I don't know that we're going to answer them. The first was, will legislation such as the People First Waiver and Employment First within the Office of People with Developmental Disabilities, OWPDD, contribute to better outcomes in employment of people with disabilities? You know, that's a challenging question to answer, because there are, as you all know, the disability policy platform is complicated, right? And so while we hope that when we implement new policy and new regulation, that it's going to address all the fears, associated with return to work and provide all of the incentives needed to encourage work, the Ticket to Work program is a good example of a policy that's yet to recognize its full potential, because there are other influencers outside of that piece of legislation's impact that contribute to employment outcomes. And so while I think that OWPDD's efforts with the People First Waiver, their Employment First agenda, definitely set an important state tone, just as similar state initiatives undertaken by other federal agents or other state agencies within New York State, I think it's premature for us to conjecture as to whether or not it's going to result in better outcomes. Would it contribute to it? I think we all hope so, and our fingers are crossed, but there are a myriad of public entitlements and benefits and incentives that we really need to teach ourselves how to braid much more effectively, and I think that it's in that braiding that potentially we might begin to see that employment needle begin to move for individuals with disabilities. But it's a really good question to throw out there and to keep us mindful of those state initiatives that come out within one organization or one agency that we need to think through, what are the implications, what are potentially the unintended consequences that might impact its success. We did have a question come in regarding the OPWDD data, and the question was specifically, you know, how many folks are in sheltered employment. And I know sheltered employment is, you know, something that's taken, you know, a great deal of interest, especially given the work of the Most Integrated Settings Coordinating Council and that employment subcommittee. And so I didn't know, Zafar, you know, whether or not your familiarity with the OPWDD data. Do we have an exact number of how many individuals are in sheltered work?
To be honest, my understanding is that there's no individual level data exists for the as I understood for those who participate in sheltered workshops. We can actually track using NISER data those individuals who after the sheltered workshop receive the support employment services, but this, as our paper, our joint paper with you and Sarah, showed that this number is not huge enough, that mostly people who are in sheltered workshop, they continue staying in sheltered workshop, and only a few of them move to the support employment services and then integrated services. Maybe those who participate in sheltered workshops move directly to competitive integrated setting, but we don't have any track of them. We don't have any individual level data, though we believe that that would be a great, if such data exists, that would be a great opportunity to do research.
Yeah, thank you, Zafar. You know, one of our go-to people within OWPDD on these types of issues is Rob Noble. He's an exceptional resource. He's been in that system, for a considerable amount of time, driving their employment agenda there and contributing to a lot of the innovative things that have come out. I know that Zafar and I have used Rob Noble as, you know, kind of a consultant and a guide to us and, you know, helping us to understand the NISER data. And so I think that if you're interested in more of a follow-up on that question, we can, if you email me, I'm more than happy to put you in touch with Rob. He's an exceptional resource for us. Here in New York State, you know, the sheltered employment population tends to be a difficult population for us to get our hands around. So while, you know, Zafar had mentioned we, you know, have done some preliminary research, you know, around the impact of more pre-vocational services as it relates to supported employment outcome, this is a population that we have yet to identify consistently in an administrative data set that we have access to. But again, you know, Rob Noble, an exceptional resource that should you follow up with me directly, I can put you in touch with Rob, and I know that you'll find him a great resource and is probably can tell you a lot of other things about OWPDD and their efforts in regard to some of their new initiatives that are coming down the pike as well. I don't think that you would mind me citing his name in this way. And if I reach out to him and he feels he's not the most appropriate person, we can definitely put you in touch with an individual who is. We did have a question about whether or not individuals can share the PowerPoint with, you know, attribution. We encourage you to disseminate both the PowerPoint but also the report. If you would just scroll forward, Sarah, just again to show people that link for the newest report that was just updated. That report is available. We encourage you to share it broadly. Share it through your listserv. Share it with policymakers that you're working with to help them understand, you know, the current experiences of New Yorkers with disabilities. So please feel free to share that PowerPoint. We do ask that you not change the content of that. And that if you do that, you make sure that you cite it appropriately and do not contribute it to Cornell University. I'm just going through the questions here. A comment, thank you, a great response on the legislation question, especially mindfulness for all on how braiding all services could possibly decrease fragmentation and improve outcomes. You know, we are learning a considerable amount about how better to braid resources. I think that the Employment Subcommittee of the Most Integrated Settings Coordinating Council has really helped lead that way, especially a lot of our state agency folks within, you know, Access VR and ODA OWPDD and the Office of Mental Health and Office of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse Services. I never should have started mentioning them because I know I'll forget one of them. But, you know, these organizations have really gotten together over the last 3 years. And besides having, you know, driven the implementation of New York State's Medicaid infrastructure grant, have really begun in-depth dialogues about how best to share resources, but also to braid not just the resources they have, but also policies. How do we make sure that our policies aren't negatively impacting one another? And so I think that New York State is well positioned, you know, going forward the next 5 years to continue some of these dialogues. So it does not look like we have any other questions. While we wait to see if any final ones do come in, I do want to extend my sincere appreciation to Bill Erickson, Sarah von Schroeder, and Zafar Nazaroff here within the Employment and Disability Institute, their efforts over the last 3 years to really surface and begin to answer tough questions about the experience of disability in New York State have just been a tremendous resource for us. So Bill and Sarah and Zafar, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for sharing your expertise with us. And given that it does not look like we have any subsequent questions, we want to thank you for joining us. Again, stay tuned to the New York Makes Work Pay listserv for announcements of additional webinars that will be coming down the pike. The most recent to be coming down will probably be one focused on the Department of Health and the Medicaid buy-in for working people with disabilities administrative data and the cost-benefit analysis that we're conducting. And should you have any questions following today's webinar, I encourage you to contact us here at the Employment and Disability Institute. As always, thanks for joining us, and have a great day.